So there's this creature called Goatman. You see him in a lot of different areas. He usually ends up around a trestle or a railroad bridge. He looks, it d differs. Usually he's a cloven-footed man. He has horns, goat-like features. The stories differ too as to where he comes from. Some say he's an industrial accident, some an escaped circus freak. Some say it's even a satanic thing that there was a satanic cult and that this man interfered in some way, or that he sacrificed goats. There's a lot of things. However, you see him in a lot of different places, usually in the southeast. The first report of this brute hails from 1957, when eyewitnesses report seeing a hairy, horn-footed monster. I'm sorry, a hairy horned monster in the areas of Forestville and Upper Marlboro in Prince George's County. Modern sightings of Goatman hail from Florida too, where many believe that it's actually misidentified Bigfoot. To various locations in Texas, including Cameron Park in Waco, White Rock Lake in Dallas, and most notably a spate of sightings in the nearby Lake Worth in 1969 by a beast which is commonly referred to as the Lake Worth Monster. He is the most famous of them in that area. He's a horrific melange of both human and goat-like characteristics. Horned, hoofed, goat-featured horror would be the modern reinterpretation of the ancient satyrs, obviously. If you know them at all, they're on whom we base our horned devil. Because, of course, in the Bible, at no point is the devil described as being a horned figure with a little pointy tail. That is mostly just tying together a bunch of different mythological features into one uber creature. He's like an uber Satan. But it's pretty clear that this is supposed to be a flesh and blood creature that's not to be messed with. Numerous accounts of the urban legend exist about the creature's origins and the method it employs to claim its victims. According to some accounts, the creature uses either hypnosis or voice mimicry to lure trespassers onto the trestle to meet their death before some oncoming train. Other stories claim that the monster jumps down from the trestle onto the roofs of cars passing beneath it. Yet other legends tell that when it attacks its victims with a bloodstained axe, and the very sight of the creature so unsettling that those who see it walking across a high trestle are driven to leap off. Now, honestly, if I were walking across a high trestle and I saw a goat man with a bloody axe, I would at least run in the other direction at top speed. I don't know what sort of speed a goat man can take on a trestle. I know my feet would get stuck between the little boards. So I don't know how fast he could go. I think I could outrun him while I was on the trestle. I don't know that I'd jump off, but I would avoid him. You don't walk toward the thing with the bloody axe, in my experience. However, it is important to note that the Goatman has legitimately caused deaths. Verifiably, the myth of the Goatman has resulted in people dying because of something called legend tripping, where kids, stupid kids, hear this story and they say, "Oh my God, let's go to the trestle. Let's check this out." And then they end up dying, you know. Maybe they don't notice the train. There was a movie made about one of these, and actually the MTA had to come, insisted that they came to the film festival where it was shown, and announced that, unlike in the movie, if a train is going by, you can't simply hang on by your fingers. Because, one, it'll take 5 to 7 minutes for a train to go over that trestle. And two, it will vibrate a lot, so you will fall to your death. And so, yes, because of legend tripping, because of people trying to experience this legend as a, fun thrill, they end up dying. There was one woman who said that there's absolutely no way that her son would have been stupid enough to have gone and done this on his own, so it must have been the goat man who did this. But it is notable that these creatures seem to show up near railroad bridges. What is also interesting is that there's one called Sheep Squatch, which cryptozoologists hate that name because it is stupid, and cryptozoologists try to take themselves very seriously, as they should. Because of cryptozoologists, we have rediscovered the okapee and the coelacanth, both of which were thought to be mythical or well extinct. So, again, we do have evidence. Numerous sightings in July of 1969 led to the belief of a half-man, half-goat creature living in Lake Worth, Texas. Terry Deckard, a reporter, wrote an article about it for a newspaper, which made the front page. The headline read, "Fishy Goat Man Terrifies Couple Parked at Lake Worth." The couple that reported the sighting described it as a half-man, half-goat with fur and scales. Here it might be important that we stop. I personally think it is ludicrous, as would any cryptozoologist, to suggest that something is half-man, half-goat with fish scales. It's too much. There are no interstitial fossils between goat and human. No matter how many Scotsman jokes you want to make, nobody has actually crossbred a human and a goat. That evolution has not happened. Nor do I think it would. It's very unlikely. You can't wield tools with hooves. So, we'll get back to this, but we're not suggesting that this is a real thing. There have been cases, real cases, that have tied into this. There was the Bunny Man, which maybe this is ostentation. This ostentation means that someone heard the myth and they're like, you know what? I am a psychopath. What I will do, I'll dress in a bunny suit and get an axe and I'm going to go after some kids. That's what I'm going to do. And so the Bunny Man is often tied into this. And Bunny Man was a legend that became fact because of ostentation. Another piece of evidence is a man named Tommy Burson, soon after the 1969 account, reported that a creature landed on his car after jumping out of a tree. An 18-inch scar was on the side of his car. That was his proof. The police, to this point, decided to investigate. Up until then, they laughed at any reports that they received, thinking it was a hoax. As they should, because really, if teenagers tell you that there is a goat man attacking them when they go to Makeout Point, maybe you want to investigate Makeout Point. That's your prerogative, but you're probably not expecting to see a goat man there. However, it is interesting to see, why would you have goats, a goat man, be the center of this legend? Because I'm pretty sure if I see a goat in person, my response is, oh my gosh, it's so freaking cute. Goats are adorable. Smelly, but adorable. And at the very least, if you're going to have a half-human, half-animal that's going to be scary, it should be an animal that can hurt people. A wolf will tear your throat out. A goat, maybe it'll hit you with its horns, but probably not. Mostly they just want to look at you and be adorable. In my experience with goats. However, you see these half-goat men through mythology frequently, and they're usually devilish or lascivious. The god Pan, and he was a god, he wasn't simply a lower-level being, a spirit, a daemon. He was goat-legged and drunk, and he liked sex. He liked encouraging sex. And here you have a goat man being around sexual experiences. The goat man seems to be inhibiting sex, but he's still around it. And of course you have the satyrs in Greco-Roman times, and they were the keepers of the woodland. They were drunk all the time, and they were known for being lustful. Or, you know, horny. And again, I want to go back to, why would it be guarding bridges? Bridges, like, that is a weird detail. Are we to assume that this is the same legend that has just moved, like, you know, maybe a goat was seen near a bridge and that legend, you know, got inflated. Somebody moves to a new school, shares that, it gets attached to that new bridge. I don't know. As to the actual origins of the Maryland Goatman, There are, of course, conflicting reports. Some involve escaped mental patients and other satanic rituals, but the most popular legend is that the Goat Man is the unfortunate result of an experiment involving one Dr. Stephen Fletcher that went horribly awry at his U.S. Department of Agriculture laboratory in Beltsville. One reporter actually called up the United States Department of Agriculture lab that is mentioned in this legend, and they said, okay, so you're talking about something that happened in the late 60s, and the Goat Man is still around. Is this the Goat Man's son? Is the Goat Man collecting Social Security? Which is a fine point. Even if the legend has not died down, and it never will, an original Goat Man would certainly be dead at this point. I think really what we have here is like a commonplace protector legend. It reminds me a lot of, the Mothman. And again, the Mothman, you have a bridge. You have Silver Bridge that collapsed. So what is it about bridges and these creatures? You know, we have satyrs that are protective nature spirits, and we have bridges. I don't know. Ask questions. I don't have answers. Okay. I don't have a segue. So I'll just say segue. You will all laugh like I said something funny and insightful. Then we'll move on to the next monster. All right. Then you have the Black Eyed Children. Now, this we know a lot more of because it occurred on the internet. For those of you who do not know, basically you have a child between 6 and 16 and they have a pretty flat affect. They want very badly to get into your home or into your car. And they have solid black eyes. Now, it's important to note, one, this is very popular on the internet. You will find no lack of stories of people who swear they've encountered these beings. You also will find no police reports, because this has literally never happened. The black-eyed kids resemble typical spooky... folklore stories in the same realm as phantom black dogs, apparitions, and mysterious monsters. They aren't supernatural. There may never have been an actual encounter. That does not stop people from continuing to see and fear them and pass on the latest tale of terror. So what happens is you're sitting somewhere, you're sitting at home, you hear a knock on the door, and you see one or two children. And at first, you don't notice that they have black eyes. Now, I personally look people in the eye a lot. Maybe you're somewhere on the autism spectrum. I don't know. But you don't look them in the eye. And they say something like, excuse me, but you have to let us in. Could you please invite us in? We have to call our mother. You have to invite us in. They're very big on you have to invite us in, which is kind of vampire logic. Vampires have to be invited in. Why do small children? All right. So there are a number of explanations that come from the mundane to the ludicrous. The mundane is you can easily buy full sclera contacts. I hear they're not very comfortable, but you can make yourself a black-eyed kid in a matter of $50 or $60. And of course, as we discussed, there's the idea of legend tripping and ostentation. So, hey, this is a really funny story. Wouldn't it be cool if we both got these black sclera contacts and then we went out and we knocked on doors? I mean, we're just knocking on doors. We're not doing anything dangerous. Of course, having heard the legend, if two kids with black eyes knock on your door and they have flat affect and they ask to come in, you might be getting your gun. Like, that is honestly what I would think might happen. At no point has a black-eyed kid been caught on camera. Now, we're not to the level of Great Britain in our constant surveillance, but we're getting there. And as with a lot of supernatural occurrences, one would think that we would have good video of a black-eyed kid at this point. None. Never happened. And of course, if you're hoaxing and they let you in, what do you do? I mean, we literally have no idea what the black-eyed kids are supposed to do when you let them in. We don't have stories from people who claim to have survived that experience, as far as I know. I did see some stuff that they're, you know, the Illuminati's foot soldiers, and they're culling the herd of the weak, and something about Satan. It's all kind of mixed up there. Also, another attempt at a reasonable explanation is mydriasis, that when you're on drugs, your eyes can, your pupils can fluctuate in size. And you also might have weirdly mechanical behavior. However, mydriasis doesn't make your whole eye do that. Like, there's honestly a point beyond which your pupils will not open, and that is called your pupils. Like, your the black of your eyes cannot get into your sclera. That's how your eyes are built. However, this story, in specific, did not exist prior to 1997. And there's a reason for that. Because the first person who claimed to have seen these was a reporter, a minor reporter, named Brian Bethel. Now, it's important to note that he has stuck by this story. And his story is pretty typical. Basically, he was sitting outside a movie theater. Two kids knocked, said they wanted to ride home. He said no. He noticed the black, feeling that they were creepy. He noticed the black of their eyes. He especially did not let them in. They were insistent. He did not let them in. They told him he had to. He didn't. That's pretty much it. They go away. However, the same day that he posts this account on a Usenet group, he also posts about Bloody Mary on alt.magic. And his message says the following. Then I thought to myself, what a situation ripe for spontaneous expression of magic. The will in this case is the belief, especially among those who were brave or foolish enough to try the ritual itself. The method by which the necessary reality shift would be accomplished is the fear the story and the imagined entity produced. So can we create something like Mary just by collective force of will? If not just childhood legends, why not gods and goddesses as well? Are they all just expressions of enough collective reality shifts, or can they somehow exist on their own? So he posts that, and later in the day, he posts a story about black-eyed kids, which again, he has stood steadfast by. Now, I have some exposure to ceremonial magic, and I understand thought forms. What this man attempted to create, what he perhaps has successfully created, is called, depending on your level of cultural appropriation, a tulpa, or a thought form, or an egregore. Basically, what you think comes into being. However, I feel like we have a very definitive, very precise origin point, because no black-eyed kids before that, and now people are claiming, whether they're just lying for the lulls of it, that they see black-eyed kids. So you are perpetuating his thought form, which, to his way of thinking, could bring it into being. This is like a horror movie supervillain sort of plan. Now we get to possibly my favorite story in all of Freudian phenomena, Jeff the Talking Mongoose. Now, just from that name, you know you love him, and you should love him. All right. Jeff was also referred to as the Talking Mongoose or the Dalby Spook, is the name given to a talking mongoose, which was claimed to inhabit a farmhouse owned by the Irving family, known as Cashin's Cap, near the hamlet of Dalby on the Island of Man. The story was given extensive coverage by tabloid press in Britain in the early 1930s. In September 1931, the Irving family, consisting of James, Margaret, and a 13-year-old daughter named Voirie, who names her child Voirie, claimed they heard persistent scratching, rustling, and vocal noises behind their farmhouse's wooden panels that variously resembled a ferret, a dog, or a baby. According to the Irvings, a creature named Jeff, G-E-F, because apparently Jeff is pronounced the same way as Jif. Clearly he's Geff the Talking Mongoose, much like you have a GIF. Introduced itself and told them it was a mongoose born in New Delhi, India, in 1852. According to Voirie, Jeff was the size of a small rat with yellowish fur and a large mousy tail. The strange noises persisted over the following days. Jim, her father, set traps and laid down poison, but to no avail. In desperation, he even tried to flush the intruder out by barking like a dog. To his surprise, it growled right back at him. The elusive creature proved to be a talented mimic. It ingratiated itself with Jim by dutifully repeating his imitations of various animals and birds. Soon he had only to name an animal, and it would promptly respond with an appropriate imitation. At other times, it made a gurgling sound, like a baby attempting to form its first words. Then it began to talk. Jeff was soon holding regular conversations with both Vori and her father. Though it seemed less friendly toward Vori's mother, Margaret. It began nesting in a box partition in Vori's room, which the family dubbed Jeff's sanctum. Only Vori was allowed to look directly at him. He would let Margaret and Jim only see him in the periphery, enough to see that something was there, but not to look at him. Vori, though, he was very fond of. Jeff was quoted as saying, "I have three attractions. I follow Vori, Mam gives me food, and Jim answers my questions." Vori seems to have been rather afraid of Jeff when he first manifested, one night even sleeping in her parents' bedroom to avoid being alone in the dark with the inhuman noises. "I'll follow her wherever you put her," Jeff snapped when he overheard the family discussing this. And it's important to know, Jeff could hear everything in the house. Like, Jeff had very keen ears. Now, we have a lot of evidence of Jeff. But one piece that is interesting to me is that Jeff would bring rabbits to Margaret to cook. He'd leave them on a rock outside. What I find interesting is, unlike you would assume from, you know, a mongoose or almost any animal, his means of killing these rabbits was he would strangle them with his forepaws. Which mongooses, I'm pretty sure, are not known for doing. The Irvings say that they gave Jeff biscuits, chocolates, and bananas, and food was left for him in a saucer suspended from the ceiling, which he took when he thought no one was watching. During the day, Jeff would reportedly roam the island, riding the back axles of buses and cars. In the evening, he would return home to share news and gossip he had picked up on his travels. Sometimes he would also read out items from the local newspapers. When he grew tired of chat, he would call it "vanished" and make himself scarce. But even as Jeff's notoriety grew, his visits to the Irvings became fewer and fewer. All right, now we've got this interesting topic. We've got this small creature who has been seen. Granted, this is all anecdotal at this point. It won't be. But of course, we want to come up with some sort of explanation. Now, I've dealt with this sort of phenomenon before, but here are some explanations that were attempted. One, Vori's cleverness. A contemporary media scholar, Jeffrey Sconce, writes that the most likely explanation is that this extra clever mongoose was an imaginary companion created by Irving's extra clever daughter. This I find unsatisfying because other people saw him. You know, this is a lot of work to manifest a being. There's also the thought, and I don't like this one, that Jeff is actually a talking mongoose. I know, he's called Jeff the Talking Mongoose. You want him to be a talking mongoose. But in the history of mongoose, there is not, one has never spoken. It has not happened. They're not talented mimics. Margaret and Vori Irving left home in 1945 after the death of James Irving. They reported that they had to sell the farm at a loss because it had a reputation for being haunted. I can't imagine why. In 1946, Leslie Graham, the farmer that bought the farm, claimed that he had shot and killed Jeff. The body displayed by Graham was, however, black and white and much larger than the famous mongoose, and Vori Irving was certain that it was not Jeff. Vori died in 2005. In an interview published late in life, she maintained that Jeff was not her creation. One of the researchers, because various paranormal researchers went in and looked into this, said that the charge of ventriloquism is best answered by the fact that Jeff has been heard when each member of the family has been alternately eliminated. It is sufficient to spend a day at Dorlish Cashin to know that, under their conditions of living, it would have been impossible to carry on ventriquilial imposition over a period of years. Which is true, like, that's a lot of work to do, and they would all have to be conspiring together. I don't love that idea. Now, here's one that I do love as a writer. A man named Nandor Fodor, who has an amazing name, who was the research officer of the International Institute of Psychical Research, stayed at the Irvings' house for a week without seeing or hearing Jeff. Fodor did not believe deliberate deception had occurred and molded a complex psychological theory to explain Jeff based on a split-off part of Jim Irving's personality. Fodor was heavily influenced by the theories of Freud and later became a practicing psychoanalyst. He pioneered the now popular theory that poltergeists are not disembodied spirits, but manifestations of conflict within the subconscious mind. Which is actually something that I like a lot. You see that in a lot of poltergeist cases. Usually it fixates on an adolescent girl. You know, you repress a girl, she's going through the change, and apparently she goes all Carrie White on you. But she doesn't know she's doing it. That's what's important. Whereas Carrie White, Carrie in the movie, knows that she's psychic, you're just sort of displacing it onto something external. Fodor goes on to say, in some yet unknown manner, a part of you may refuse to be confined within your body. And he says this in an article called, and I love this, I Psychoanalyze Ghosts. Beautiful. It may perform your unconscious desires, even though you think you have nothing to do with it. When this happens, you have a poltergeist. If not a fraud, then might Jeff have been a poltergeist or spiritual entity? Fodor thought not, for three reasons, and these are good ones. None of the family were psychic. Apparently you can test that. Jeff exhibited no truly supernormal powers or knowledge, despite occasionally giving the impression he had. Jeff was amazing at being, like, a braggart. He had quite the personality. Jeff had been seen, photographed, and touched, and he consistently appeared in the guise of a small furry animal. In this, incidentally, he differed from Jim Irving, who considered Jeff to be a spirit in animal form. Which occasionally Jeff would say he was. Jeff said he was a spirit, an animal in spirit form, just an animal, the eighth wonder of the world from the fifth dimension who will split the atom. Poltergeists are always invisible, Fodor explains. Jeff never claims to be without an animal form. He eats, drinks, and sleeps. He leaves teeth marks on the butter and in the larder and in the fat of the bacon. He catches rabbits and performs various other services for the family. Poltergeists are an unmitigated affliction. Jeff is an asset. Which I totally wanted Jeff. Just so we're clear, I wanted Jeff. As I look back as a psychologist on my memories of Irving, one fact stands out which my story does not reveal. He was a man who failed in life and whose many passions were too strong to bear his failure with resignation. The problem of mental starvation, for a man of Jim Irving's intelligence, must have been even more serious. There was no way to relieve it by conscious means. So his unconscious took care of the job and produced a strange hybrid of Jeff, fitting no category of human, animals, or ghosts, yet having common features of all of them. Had Irving been a student of psychical research, the development of Jeff would have proceeded, I believe, on more occult lines. So here we have something not unlike the Black Eyed Kids, except the Black Eyed Kids was apparently a cynical and intentional creation. Fodor seems to believe that Jim Irving unintentionally created Jeff, imposed his will upon a passing animal? I don't know. But that doesn't fully explain why Jeff really didn't want to be seen by Jim. Also why he is spelled G-E-F, because that's not how you spell Jeff. Some people think that it was a hoax by the entire family. Although some psychic investigators thought that Jeff was a poltergeist or ghost, skeptics that included the residents of the Isle of Man believed that the Irving family had colluded to perpetuate a hoax that was originated by the daughter Voiry. In an Isle of Man Examiner reporter wrote that when he caught the girl making noises, her father tried to convince him that the sound came from somewhere else. According to Joe Nickel, researchers had suspected Voiry used ventriloquism and other tricks, the effects of which were hyped by family members. Reporters in the search of the story, and credulous paranormalists. I mean, Jeff was sort of a tourist trap. He was interesting. People went and visited the Isle of Man so they could see Jeff. Again, I did mention that we have evidence, and we do. A researcher named Price visited the Irvings and observed the double walls of wooden paneling covering the interior room of the old farmhouse, which featured considerable interior airspace between stone and wood that made the whole house one great speaking tube with walls like sounding boards. By speaking to one of the many apertures of the panels, it should be possible to convey the voice to various parts of the house. So, if you were a ventriloquist, the entire house could be your puppet. It's here, and it was said that Jeff's hearing powers were phenomenal. It was no use whispering. It detects a whisper 15 to 20 feet away, and it tells what you are whispering and repeats exactly what one has said. Now again, if you remove, let's say Vori is the ventriloquist, if you remove her from the house and then you have this experience and you still have Jeff responding to you, that's curious. Also, it should be noted, I don't think a 13-year-old girl and a 40-something-year-old man can quite make the same ventriloquial sounds. Jeff had obviously taken an instant dislike to Captain McDonald, one of the researchers. He says, "I look at the man and I don't like him," he told Jim. "He does not believe in me. He is a doubter." Now, apparently, being a doubter was the worst possible thing for Jeff. And oftentimes he would insist he would not talk around someone purely because he felt like they would doubt him. Mrs. Irving tried her utmost. Mrs. Irving tried her utmost to persuade Jeff to talk to McDonald, but in vain. "He's damn well not gonna get to know my inferiority complex," declared the intractable mongoose. Which is great. He has all these wonderful quotes. You don't really get that with Goatman. Jim prompted Jeff to demonstrate his smattering of foreign languages by asking, "What does the rabbi say?" To which the mongoose responded, "And you have to forgive me if you understand Hebrew, because..." "Veho hefto le makto chomocho," which is "love thy neighbor as thyself." Again, depending, like, does Voiry know Hebrew? Does Voiry know that? Does Jim know that? Could Jim speak the languages that Jeff could? Because if Jeff can do one solitary thing that someone in the house cannot, that sort of does prove the point. Researchers wanted to get hair off the mongoose, because obviously if it's a physical being, it has hair. And so eventually, Jeff conceded that he would give them hair, though he insisted he pulled it out of his eyebrows, and it hurt quite a lot. And a scientist, Mr. Duncan, responded, "I've carefully examined microscopically and compared them with hairs of known origin. As a result, I can very definitively state that the specimen hairs never grew upon a mongoose, nor are they those of a rat, rabbit, hare, squirrel, or other rodent. I'm inclined to think that these hairs have probably been taken from a longish-haired dog or dogs." It's important to note, the Irvings had a longish-haired dog. Okay, so that would pretty much debunk things. Jim Irving raised this matter with Jeff, pointing out that Mr. Duncan had thought the hairs came from the dog, to which Jeff responded, "He should not think, he should know. He damn well does not know what I am." Which is the best response. The researcher, Price, asked Reginald Potok... I'm sorry. Researcher Price asked Reginald Pocock of the Natural History Museum to evaluate paw prints allegedly made by Jeff in plasticine, together with an impression of his supposed tooth marks. Pocock could not match them to any known animal, though he conceded that one of them might have conceivably been made by a dog. He did state that none of the markings had been made by a mongoose. Now, before we release Jeff into the wild, I want to share with you some of his quotes. He has said, reportedly, "I have three spirits, and their names are Foe, Faith, and Truth." I don't know what that means. He noticed that Jim was reading the Bible, and he said, "Look at the pious old atheist reading the Bible. He will swear in a minute." He also said, "I am not evil. I could be if I wanted. You don't know what damage or harm I could do if I were roused. I could kill you all, but I won't." After being asked where he would go when he died, "To hell! To the land of mist!" Of course, his most famous quote is, I'll split the atom. I'm the fifth dimension. I'm the eighth wonder of the world." He also is known to have said, "I'm a freak. I have hands and I have feet. And if you saw me, you'd faint. You'd be petrified, mummified, turned into stone, or pillar of salt. If you knew what I know, you'd know a hell of a lot." That's wise. On another occasion, Margaret found herself being pelted with stones as she walked home. "Is that you, Jeff?" she called out. "Yes, Maggie the Witch Woman, the Zulu Woman, the Honolulu Woman," taunted the impertinent mongoose. Jeff also delighted in throwing pebbles and sand up from the window, sometimes late at night. Segway. Okay. Shadow people. These are pretty common in contemporary mythology. And what is unfortunate for me with the shadow people is that shadowy shapes are a universal concept. Our brains are still set to wilderness survival. And so that shadow out of the corner of our eye, maybe it's something that wants to kill and eat us. And so we are conditioned to fear unfamiliar and distorted shadows. The Chumash tribe in California saw who they called the Dark Watchers, who would appear at ridges at twilight, which, if you know anything about, like, optometry, is not really the prime point where your eyes are seeing things clearly. Our brain has a lot of blind spots. At any given time, you actually see about 40% of what you think you see. Your brain is filling in the rest. And so in that other 60%, there's a lot of information, a lot of distortion. Now, psychical researchers, or whatever you want to call them, parapsychologists, they suggest a lot of things. A lot of people are like, "Oh, well, the shadow people, they are demons." The shadow people are, as it sounds, shadowy people, often hooded. Sometimes they have hats. I don't know. But they're shadows. They're living shadows. They don't seem to communicate. They seem almost universally malevolent. I've yet to hear a story about, like, their friendly neighborhood shadow man. They inspire fear. So people think maybe they're demons. Usually they're not seen as, like, the souls of the departed. And again, we have to go back to tulpas. I apologize, but we do. Because these seem to manifest the way you want them to. You can pretty much cause yourself to experience shadow men. If you're recording this reading at night, that thought just ran through your head. So if you believe you will see shadow men, you are much more likely to pull them out of your dreams to start seeing them. So again, the theories are demon, astral travel, that these are people who are astrally traveling to you. They're out of their bodies right now, which is not what I tend to hear from people who say they astrally travel. Maybe they are aliens, at which point I don't think so. Sorry. Time travelers, that this is just the impression they're leaving on our time. Transdimensional beings, that the shadow people exist in a different dimension than we do. Not simply that, you know, they're the dimension around the corner, but they're like the fifth dimension or something, that they're poking through. This is as much of their face as they can show us. And it's important that we can't actually give them faces, you know. Whereas Jeff the Talking Mongoose is Jeff the Talking Mongoose, a specific entity. Shadow people are shadow people. They are generic. They are... We don't ascribe them personhood. You know, much like all aliens are just aliens, we see shadow people as unknowable beings. Aside from potentially being poltergeists, the theory I like best is that we're dealing with djinn. That these are beings of smokeless fire. Not a lot to back that up, but I like it. And unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on whether or not you like these stories, we have a lot of scripts that we can pull from. Much like people say, oh, shadowy people, those must be demons, because they have that script. We have the script of media. We have Dementors. We have the movie Ghost, where shadowy people pulled the bad spirits away. We have Gravelings, you know. So if we see a shadowy thing, our mind fills in what that could be. Our mind thinks Dementor. So you just saw a shadow passing, but your brain has the schema for Dementor. So that's what you saw. Now there's a case that I like, because I like science. I like when it touches on the weird, especially the weird that's going on in our brain. So they did transcranial stimulation on this woman who had epilepsy. And they induced her to experience a shadow person. She saw it, she recognized it. It was often right behind her, trying to take books out of her hand. They tweaked the transcranial stimulation on the left parietal juncture. They shocked it, and suddenly she was sitting in the shadow being's lap, and it had its arms wrapped around her. So what is thought is that if you're really experiencing it to that effect, you are putting yourself where you are not. It's also interesting to note that there's 19 megahertz. It's a very low-level sound. And it is, as far as I'm concerned, the ghost sound. If I started playing 19 megahertz right now, it causes your eyeballs to vibrate in such a way that you start to see things. You know that little blind spot you have? That little blind spot gets definitive. You can see what you can't see. And it also creates a primal response in you, supposedly because this is roughly the sound that a growling tiger makes. I don't know. But it is evolutionarily better that you be paranoid. Like, it's better that you jump at shadows than that you don't. Because the person who's like, oh god, shadow! When there's nothing there, lives. The guy who's like, there's nothing over there, when it's like an axe-wielding maniac, he dies. He doesn't pass on those fearless genes. Which brings us finally to the reptilians. You have probably seen the reptilians, however you want to take that statement. The official story, depending on how far you want to take it, is this. The reptilians were an alien species that came from far, far, far away. They genetically engineered humanity, but we got away from them because of another reptilian species that was already here. Now, this immediately makes me think, oh my god, did the dinosaurs save us from the reptilians? That's apparently not where the conspiracy theorists go with this. I don't know why. But basically, what a reptilian is a 7 or 8 foot tall reptile, possibly from another dimension or planet, that is controlling all of human civilization. Again, we have a good script for this. We have movies like V, or miniseries like V, where you have reptiles in cloned human skin. Now, one could think, a lot of this was pioneered by a man named Zacharia Sitchin, and a man named David Icke took that football and ran with it. So if there's any conspiracy theory, I can guarantee you it ties back to the reptilians. Guarantee it. Supposedly, Dan Rather... Actually, no, this isn't supposedly. This happened. Dan Rather was attacked by a gun-wielding follower of David Icke who thought that Dan Rather knew the frequency that the reptilians were putting out. You know that REM song, What's the Frequency, Kenneth? That is actually all about that. Dan Rather was attacked. However, there's also the thought that Dan Rather is a reptilian who was taken out because he went after Bush. Now, this confused me until I found out, apparently, in the whole little hierarchy, the reptilian pawns that have more reptilian blood, they're better and purer. And we let those people be leaders, the ones who have the most reptilian blood. You thought you lived in a representative democracy. No. It's all about alien transdimensional reptile blood. I'm sorry to break it to you. That's how it actually works. But people have tried. Supposedly, V did not inspire people to think they're reptilians, but V was a script that was someone trying to tell humanity what was actually going on. Supposedly, on that subject, Stanley Kubrick's movie Eyes Wide Shut, yes, the one with Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman going to orgies, was supposed to be a demonstration of the reptilians. It was shot in a Rothschild mansion, and the Rothschild family is supposed to be high-level reptilians. I don't know. But it's ridiculous to think that Stanley Kubrick would try to tell us about reptilians through Eyes Wide Shut. I mean, he only exposed the moon landing through The Shining, so obviously he doesn't care about that sort of stuff. So apparently, reptilians like drinking human blood, which I would think would be hella toxic if you were from another planet or dimension. However, if they genetically engineered and bred us to be their slaves, maybe they figured out that we should be edible to them. I think they're just way more efficient ways to get palatable blood than to raise humanity. We're kinds of pains in the butt. But the way you keep your reptile blood pure is that you breed with other reptile pawns. So that's why the British royal family has a lot, because, you know, they have married cousins. So what I discovered is that Zacharias Sitchin's whole idea about the reptilians was based on just bad linguistics. A cornerstone of his ancient aliens theory is that this is the Sumerian word mu, which he translated to people from the conical-shaped fiery rocket from the heavens. Sumerians, however, gave us a lexicon, and the word basically means the sky. So, I don't know how you squeeze people from the conical-shaped fiery rocket of the heavens into the two letters MU, but apparently you do. However, a lot of this ancient alien stuff, it's like a game of telephone. Like, he says one thing, and then it just keeps getting distorted until it's way beyond acceptable. Most of the current internet following for reptilians is based on YouTube videos. And this is a shame, because they watch them, and there are these things called P-frames. And they're really predictive frames in YouTube videos. And so the video basically figures out what should be in that video. It's a compression tactic. Rather than having each frame be like photo perfect, it's more or less a guess. Sometimes the P frame doesn't guess right and you get weird distortions. So people are like, oh look, his eyes are reptilian slits. Clearly he's a monster. Alright, but back to Sitchin. He believed that the Anunnaki, the Sumerian gods, were actually reptilians. They are never referred to as being reptilian in any fashion or having reptile blood. The closest connection is that the god Enki was the patron of a town on a stream called the Serpent's Marsh. So Enki would occasionally come out of the Serpent's Marsh. That's it. You know, you come out of the Hudson, that doesn't make you a reptilian. It does mean you're covered in PCBs, but not a reptilian. But you see the serpent in a lot of mythology. You know, you see, you know, the serpent seduced Eve. And if you want to go into rabbinical tradition, you have Lilith, Adam's first wife, who is thought to have be reptilian in some way. However, as I said, you can tie all the crazy into the reptilians. Because supposedly, the Anunnaki then went to Ireland for some reason, at which point they bred with the tribe of Danu, creating elves. I'm not kidding. Then they also, maybe the elves, I'm not positive, but someone with reptilian blood then goes to France and spawns the Merovingians, who apparently perpetuated the story that they had both the blood of Christ and the blood of the serpent. How does this happen? I'm glad you asked. What you do? You get pregnant by a guy who is a direct descendant of Jesus Christ, which means Jesus Christ got it on. Feel however you want about that. So she got pregnant, and then she's like, now that I'm pregnant with a god spawn, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go swimming. So she goes swimming in a pond, and there she gets pregnant by a serpent, as I think happens to most girls. At least that's what I learned from high school health class. If you go swimming, a snake will inseminate you. Sorry. Now the reptilians are like the conspiracy. Like, they're the Illuminati for the Illuminati. They're above them. They're above everything. They control the entire planet. Like, the Illuminati is, they're peanuts. Of course, the actual Bavarian Illuminati was all about feminism and education. Whatever. That doesn't matter right now. But reptilians serve as a really good scapegoat. Like, oh, I don't like that political leader. They're a reptilian. Like, that is something clearly not human. Those monsters. So, apparently, the Pleiadians, those big-eyed gray guys, they help us out. They fight the reptilians. I don't know. I don't actually understand what their motivation to do this would be. I'm, you know, glad for the assist. But overall, like, I don't like random spookiness. I want my creepiness to have a basis in fact. It's easier to just make things up. Trust me. That's how I earn my living. But I need something else when I'm connecting to real people. I can't guarantee that any of this is true. Like, I'm giving you the story, but I can't promise you it's true.